Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now, just before we talk to Dan Hodges from the Mail on Sunday, let's have a listen to Boris Johnson, who's explaining now why he's decided it's a great idea to self-isolate.
Hi, folks. Like so many hundreds of thousands of other people across the country, I've been pinged. I've been asked to self-isolate by the test, trace and isolate system after I've been in contact with somebody who has COVID, in this case, of course, the Health Secretary, Sajid Javid. And we did look briefly at the idea of us taking part in the pilot scheme, which allows people to test daily. But I think it's far more important that everybody sticks to the same rules. And that's why I'm going to be self-isolating until the 26th of July, Monday, the 26th of July. And I know how frustrating it all is, but I really do urge everybody to stick with the program and take the appropriate course of action when you're asked to do so by NHS Test and Trace.
It's quite hard to keep a straight face, isn't it? Dan Hodges, very good morning to you.
Morning.
So, it's very important that everybody sticks to the same rules, Dan. So, does that mean that all the people who are part of this mysterious trial stroke pilot system are now going to stop doing it?
Well, apparently, the government's now said they're not going to take part in it anymore,
right?
Which is good and is proper. But as you saw, I mean, the Prime Minister there was saying, they briefly thought about taking part in it, and he was lying. They hadn't briefly thought about taking part in it. The government's been taking part in this scheme since May. Michael Gove benefited from it. Other ministers, officials have been eligible for it. And frankly, as we saw in that clip on this issue, Boris is basically trying to treat everybody in Britain like we're all mugs, frankly. Mm.
I know. Seems remarkable, because I'm pretty sure the last time you and I spoke, Dan, you said you'd asked the Prime Minister's office or to Downing Street in one way or another how you could apply to be part of this trial that Michael Gove was on, and they never bothered answering you.
That's right. I mean, I got pinged coming back from the G7, as a number of us who attended that joyous event did, and spent a couple of days, asked Downing Street, asked the Department of Health, tried online to see, you know, how we get access to this scheme so we could get daily tested. I mean, I was double jabbed, and answer came there none. And I'd actually written a piece the week before, you know, pointing out this ridiculous one rule for them, one rule for everyone else loophole they were using. So, which is why I say the idea that Boris, you know, somehow became aware of it, somehow became eligible for it, and then just suddenly decided, actually, no, of course, it's not for us. I mean, it's complete rubbish, as we all know.
Yeah, exactly right. And there's some confusion as to who's been using this and utilising it, right? Because Transport for London at one point was supposed to be, but then yesterday we were told that the Metropolitan line was closing down because it didn't have enough people to run it on the basis that they were all at home self-isolating. You're kind of going, well, surely if they're in this trial, they can't be self-isolating. So are they in it or are they not in it?
Well, that's one of the things. I mean, I, again, specifically asked who'd be in it. I was told, I was told private sector companies were not going to have their identities revealed, but I was told a number of public sector organisations were utilising it, and I was specifically told one of them was Transport for London. Mm. But then yesterday, Transport for London popped up and said no, they weren't using it and hadn't been told that they now had permission to use it.
Yeah, so it's all very confusing, isn't it? And meanwhile, of course, you've got the Labour Party coming out today saying that, you know, this is reckless, even though they support it. I can't quite work out where their position is on this.
No, I don't understand where the Labour Party's position on reopening is today. I mean, they're saying it's dangerous, it's reckless. But my understanding is technically they support all the measures that the government has announced, with the possible exception of masks. Mm. Given it seems to be most of the public transport operators are saying they're going to require people to wear masks anyway, I'm not entirely sure what Labour's position is. And as I think we discussed last week, given what we're seeing today, no more social distancing in pubs, no more social distancing in restaurants, no more social distancing in nightclubs, people able to go back to work. The idea that in that context, wearing a mask for a few minutes is going to significantly impact on the spread of the virus is completely, I mean, it's for the birds, right?
Yeah, well, it really is. But isn't it now the case that people who are, I mean, COVIDiots is trending, for example, on Twitter. And I hate using Twitter as any kind of bellwether for anything, really. But, you know, these sort of so-called clever people having a go at anyone who thinks the pandemic's gone, having a go at anyone who wants to take their mask off, making out that the people who do want freedom are in some way stupid, uneducated, probably Brexiteers, almost certainly right wing. You know, what's happened?
Well, I mean, you know, you and I have been debating this for a good length of time.
Yeah.
And you know exactly what my position's been. My position has always been, we need to get people jabbed, but once we've got people jabbed, then we've got to move forward. And it's the people who I was calling, you know, the lockdown deniers, lockdown skeptics,
yeah,
have you, who in my view were wrong about this, who kept saying it's never going to end. Well, it has ended. I mean, you know, it's opened up today. So arguing, well, we should extend, we should just extend just for another month or just another month or another month. I mean, it is so counterproductive. Firstly, because in my view, it emboldens those people who've been saying, oh, it's all a conspiracy, they'll never let us out. But the other key thing is, comes back to the vaccine. We were told, get vaccinated. The vaccine is the route out of this crisis. If you get vaccinated, we can then return to normal. We can then reopen. Well, that's what in the main people have done.
Yeah.
So having done that, you can't then say to them, oh, actually, do you know what? We know we told you if you got vaccinated, this will be the end of it, but you've got vaccinated, yeah, isn't it?
And in that sense, I think Boris has got it right. You know, for him to say when he did say it a couple of Mondays ago, you know, we're going to have to lift the lockdown at some point, and now is as good a time as any to do it. And I was certainly never one of those who said that we would never get out of it. I was also one of those, however, who did say that lockdowns have got limited appeal. And certainly there are those people who think we will be in another lockdown, and I don't know if they're the same people that said we'd never get out of this one. I'm not so sure I believe that, because I think genuinely speaking, you know, looking at the numbers and the figures that we've got in front of us, there are some scaremongering people out there saying, oh, look at the rates going up as fast as they were going up in January. That's not true. And the number of tests that we're doing is prodigious, out of all proportion to what we should be doing. I saw a statistic the other day that we've tested something like 250 million times in this country, and that's just the ones that we've actually registered. You know, that's ludicrous, isn't it?
Except, well, yes. And I mean, I think the key for me to this, I mean, I wrote this in my column yesterday. If you go back 4 weeks ago, remember, which was supposed to be the original Freedom Day, Boris announced he was going to delay for an extra 4 weeks. And at that press conference, Chris Whitty was standing beside one side, Patrick Vallance the other, and they both backed that move. And Patrick Vallance at the time said, look, be perfectly honest, we've looked at the data, we've looked at the figures, we've looked at the vaccinations. There comes a point where delaying any further the reopening, you don't really get much more of a significant health benefit. Mm. He was very clear about that. We are now at that point. Now, suddenly, as ever, Patrick Vallance and Chris Whitty are suddenly shifting tack and are suddenly saying, oh, well, you know, we've got to be a little bit careful. But the reality is there has always been a balance to be struck between how we protect society by directly protecting public health and how we protect society by enabling society to get back to normal in the way that we all have to if we, frankly, are all going to survive. And it seems to me we've reached that point now. You're absolutely right. We can see the infection rates, but we can also see the hospitalisation rates, and we can also see the mortality rates. And tragic though any death is, the idea that we should be continuing to lock down the country based on the hospitalisation and death figures that we have now is, in my view, simply not justifiable.
No, it really isn't. Dan, stay with us for a moment. We're going to take a short break. Dan Hodges, Man on Sunday commentator, with us talking about Freedom Day, which is today.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. We're talking to Dan Hodges, Man on Sunday commentator, of course. And Dan, you were talking in your column yesterday about the sort of the surrounding noise and kerfuffle, because it still hasn't gone away. I mean, I listened to a guy yesterday from University of Wellington in New Zealand, who was part of a group of scientists who have written a letter in which they basically declared Britain's policy on COVID to be completely not just reckless, but dangerous. And you just think to yourself, you know, I heard him being interviewed and he was talking about being worried about the NHS being overwhelmed. I'm like, you live in New Zealand, you know, what's it going to do with you, to be honest, about the NHS?
Is this the guy, is this the report that basically said what we're doing is going to, could lead to the end of the world?
Basically,
something?
Yes. Yeah, but they've got something like 80 scientists who have signed up to it. I mean, it's like the opposite of the Great Barrington Report.
I mean, look, I think one of the things that we have to acknowledge, and I wouldn't say this about all the experts, although I, you know, again, I've, you know, been critical in the past about some of the advice we've been given, to put it mildly. But I think we've got to be honest. You've got to remember that, you know, this has been a very, very difficult, hard, horrendous in many ways time for the last 18 months. But there are a lot of people and there are a lot of experts, sort of so-called experts around the world who frankly have been having the time of their lives over the last 18 months. Suddenly, you know, they've been sitting there beavering away in their offices in these sort of obscure academic institutions, nobody outside of their own particular field taking that much notice of them. And suddenly, if they come up, and they, you know, we see this all the time, if they come up with a particularly apocalyptic vision of what is about to happen, and it always leans that way, you know, it has to be apocalyptic. It has to be, this is the wrong thing. It's going to get worse. Billions are going to die. If they do that, then that's their key to a little bit of minor celebrity. Mm. So, and they recognize, I think, that, you know, the gravy train is coming to an end now. So I'm afraid we're going to be getting a bit more of this over the next few weeks and months.
Well, I'm hoping so, because I don't know how much you know about what Sage and Nerve Tag did before the pandemic, if anything. I mean, are we going to be rid of them? Susan Mickey was on this morning again talking about how this is too soon, it's too early. You know, we've heard her before saying we should be wearing masks all the time anyway. I mean, will Boris actually finally make a decision, which is not his forte at the moment, and just say to Sage, look, take a step back, have a long holiday, go somewhere, not France, because you can't go there, but basically just go away for a while?
Well, I think, no, I mean, I think, firstly, I think we need Sage, we need an organisation like Sage. I mean, speaking to people in government, I think there is a feeling that Sage has, over the course of the crisis, become too unwieldy. I mean, when I first heard about Sage, I thought, you know, there'd be like a dozen, you know, great and the good. I mean, there are apparently hundreds and hundreds of people.
There's loads of them, yeah.
On this thing, I think their role in this has to be examined. I think if you look at what they were saying at the start of the pandemic and the way things have panned out, they have got a lot of stuff wrong. But frankly, on this, I'm not going to let Boris duck his responsibility on this. I mean, I've said, you know, again, I wrote about it. It's quite clear that Whitty and Vallance are changing tack, and to an extent have pulled the rug out over the last 4 weeks from what they were saying 4 weeks ago and giving him cover 4 weeks ago. But at the end of the day, Boris has got to man up on this sort of stuff. He's the prime minister. He's the one who's got to make the decisions on this. You know, we saw the shambles yesterday. We've got the ongoing shambles, actually, we haven't talked about, which is the whole pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
In which we can see what is coming down the track. I mean, literally in the next couple of weeks, this country is going to grind to a halt, because millions of people who are perfectly healthy are going to be forced to sit at home and isolate for 10 days, and the nation's services are going to grind to a halt. Now, we know that is going to, we know today.
But surely that is easily preventable, Dan. All you got to do is stop doing it. It's just end the policy.
Exactly. But again, Boris at the moment is, I mean, he's kind of lost his way again the last weeks, and you see this on a number of issues, but he's basically caught like a rabbit in headlights at the moment. He knows what's happening with the pandemic. He knows a decision is going to have to be taken to change the way everybody isolates, particularly those in very important services. But he just can't take a decision at the moment. So we will have the situation, and we've seen that before from Boris. No decision will be taken. The crisis will develop. It will reach a critical point, at which point Boris will be forced to act. But by that point, the damage will have been done.
Well, I actually thought yesterday, I mean, we've got such a weird situation going on at the moment with the way the government operates, that I actually thought yesterday, if they stick to this idea that they're going to take part in this pilot system and this trial, and they're not going to self-isolate, I was beginning to wonder if that was deliberate to make people just forget about the system and go, well, we're not doing it if you're not doing it, so get stuffed. And then suddenly it was all reversed again.
I mean, I said it yesterday. I mean, I've been working in politics and writing about politics for a long time. And normally when politicians do daft things, you can see somewhere in the background some sort of rationale. You know, you may disagree with it, but you can understand it. What they thought they were doing yesterday, and frankly, it's going to be interesting. I mean, I want to spend a bit this week trying to have a dig around and find out what happened, because we haven't got to the bottom of it. There's a reason why. Boris must have known perfectly well what a political hit he was going to take.
Yeah, I mean, surely that couldn't have been a surprise. I mean, I was hearing people saying last night, oh, well, they didn't realise quite what the backlash would be. Well, why not?
I mean, how? I mean, the backlash had already been occurring. Like I said, I wrote about it. Other people were writing about it. Questions were being asked in the House of Commons about this scheme. And yet he still somehow thought he could get away with it. Mm. And I genuinely don't know how or why. And it does raise questions moving forward about what is going on in number 10 at the moment. And, you know, we've all seen all the psychodrama since Dom Cummings got booted out. We all know the problems and the issues around Dom Cummings. You know, he's no mate of mine. Mm. But equally, it's quite clear that since Cummings left, there's a political hole sitting at the heart of Downing Street. Yeah. Boris doesn't know which way to turn. He doesn't know whether to stick a twist. He doesn't know whether to fight the culture war or try and end the culture war. He doesn't know whether to push ahead with Freedom Day or delay Freedom Day. He doesn't know whether he should deal with the pingdemic or sit back until it just everything grinds to a halt. And, you know, he's going to have to get a grip, because if he doesn't, then what was supposed to be the end today of the great pandemic crisis, it could actually just be the start of it politically.
Well, yeah, because we're now about to go, by the time he comes back from his self-imposed isolation, it's going to be recess, it's going to be summertime, and all they're going to talk about, presumably from this point on, is climate change, and they're going to be working their way up to the whole Glasgow conference. And I imagine that it'll just drift, won't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, exactly. I mean, if all we're going to get, you know, with all these other issues, if all we're going to do is, you know, is Boris, you know, embracing his whole big, you know, hug a fish agenda, then he's going to be in serious, political trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, speaking to Tory MPs yesterday, you know, they were, sometimes when you speak to Tory MPs, they go, oh, for God's sake, Boris, it's just, you know, what's he like? Mm. But it's kind of Boris being Boris. Yesterday, it was literally, I don't understand what's going on. How could they have done?
Well, it's getting harder and harder to stand behind him and say what he's doing is right. Even though some of them are still doing that, there's less of them, fewer of them.
Well, because he's not prepared to stand behind what he's doing himself. Mm. You know, this was supposed to be the great Freedom Day. Suddenly it's, you know, don't be too free.
Yeah, doesn't feel like it, does it?
Go to a nightclub. Go to a nightclub, but be careful how you go to a nightclub.
Yeah.
How do you carefully go to a nightclub? What does that mean in this context?
I really don't know.
Go to the pub. Go to the pub and stand at the bar with your mates, but do it carefully.
Yeah.
Well, what does that mean? You know?
I know. And we shouldn't really be asking that question. We are asking it simply because it's been done so badly. I mean, I don't really want them to tell me how to stand at the bar. You know what I mean? And so I don't wish to ask them permission to do it. So I'll do it. But also, I don't need to be told to do it carefully. I mean, you know, what am I, 10?
But again, it's the situation where they say, right, we're going to give you personal responsibility. We're going to stop telling you what to do. But Do it carefully. Come on.
I know. Bizarre, isn't it? Great to talk to you, Dan. Thanks very much indeed. Dan Hodges, Mel on Sunday commentator there. As puzzled, I think, as many people are by what on earth is it that they are doing? Freedom Day. Does it feel like that for you?
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Let's talk to Michael Kill, Chief Executive of the Nighttime Industries Association, who I'm sure will be very, very happy that last night at midnight, an awful lot of clubs, nightclubs in particular, were allowed to open and did open. Michael, very good morning to you.
Good morning.
I guess for you, this is Freedom Day personified, isn't it?
It very much is. But as you can understand, since we've heard the announcement from the Prime Minister, there's been some levied concern or caution, and as you can understand, right the way throughout the week, and up until the point that the guidance was released, which was very late in the day, there was concern from operators on exactly what the expectation was. So, you know, it's been a huge challenge. Obviously, there were people that opened last night, early hours of the morning, which was great to see, and the feedback's been great. But the big one is this weekend, where we need to deliver and make sure that we're generating safe environments for customers and particularly our staff to come back to.
Yes, and I don't know whether it's too early to say, but do you have any idea roughly of how many clubs actually opened last night and opened their doors and actually did business?
It was differing. I mean, in major cities, they opened up because the opportunity was there potentially with a footfall. Outside of that, it was very limited. I think we estimated from a straw poll, potentially between 20 and 30% businesses tried to open their doors. But the majority of those were in major cities, not in the suburbs or urban sort of development areas. So for us, we saw some open, but not the levels that we're potentially going to see over the weekend.
Right. And how was it? I mean, were people just going back to normal as if it was? I mean, I was just talking to Dan Hodges there, who was saying it's a bit confusing, this whole Freedom Day thing, where they're saying, go to a nightclub, but do it carefully. And people are kind of going, sorry, what do you mean by that exactly?
There's been a huge amount of confusion, ambiguity in the way that the guidance has been represented, you know, from COVID passport to not COVID passport to, you know, make sure you get a negative test, not, you know, it's been extremely confusing in terms of what's mandating and not what's not. And the industry have had to do a big job in terms of letting their customers know, because they're confused, let alone the operators. And for the guidance to come out so late, it's been extremely troubling. But look, I think last night, the outpour of emotion of people being back into these types of premises and enjoying some sort of level of social freedom, but with caution and with some measures in place, which, you know, we feel are necessary to ensure that we uphold our end of the bargain, because the last thing we want is to be closed down in several months' time leading into the winter and autumn, which is where the concern is levied at the
Yes. moment. And my understanding from people I've heard speaking as club owners is that they aren't operating any kind of testing system because it would just be too complicated.
Well, it's extremely challenging. I mean, you know, even with the app system that we've been presented with, if you take a lateral flow test, which, as you can appreciate, with the majority of our age groups not being vaccinated, part of it is self-certification or presenting a negative test. It could be anyone's test. So, you know, we're still levied with a real level of concern in terms of fraudulence. You know, that on top of ID, that on top of arguments with people who are potentially intoxicated, which we can't let in as well. You can imagine the divisive nature of a front door.
Yes.
You know, coming up, and those frontline staff we've got to consider and protect. And it's one of the challenges that we've had back to government in terms of clarity and the way that this has been set up.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I'm absolutely in agreement with you. It's a tough enough job running a door at a nightclub without having to do all of that sort of business as well, because one of the things we're going to talk about later on the show is the whole Wembley fiasco and the fact that their security was so awful. And I'm told by people who were there that one of the reasons it was probably as bad as it was all of the security people were concerned only with one thing, and that was to see whether or not you had some kind of either COVID passport or you could show that you'd had a negative test, and everything else didn't matter.
Well, it's interesting you should mention it. I mean, we work very closely with security. The conditions on our license on many of the premises out there say you have to have a certain level of security. The feedback we got was that there potentially were some shortages there, and that's a long-standing issue in terms of the security sector. So the worry we have, and something we're seeing right the way across the board, is businesses having to close because conditions on their license that require them to have a certain level of security are not able to be fulfilled because people have left that sector because it's been closed for such a long time, either Brexit's hit or, you know, we're sat challenged by an environment where people have gone off and found other jobs and they're not back to it. And, you know, there is a huge shortage, not only of chefs, but also of SIA licensed security. And it's a big issue in terms of the front line, particularly as there's so much focus on protect duty and, you know, that security line being that first line of defence in terms of counter-terror.
Well, this is the thing. And as far as the way the businesses are able to reopen and what are the sort of practical problems of having something shut for as long as it's been shut, effectively, you know, 18 months more or less, presumably they've had to expend money on keeping the, you know, the place clean, keeping it sort of spick and span, making sure the air conditioning systems are running and working and all of that.
There's a huge amount of work to do. I mean, you know, 7 days notice is not enough. We saw the outcry off the back of the 21st. But, you know, you're talking about water systems to, you know, maintenance of air conditioning systems, drink delivery, you know, food outlets if you're serving food, training of staff, because there's a whole another level of training that's got to come in now. And you're talking about those additional public health requirements that have got to come in place and remain in place until we, you know, we get to a sufficient point that we can let them go, if we ever let them go. So for us, there's a massive amount of work to do. And I think the government underestimate how committed and driven our industry are to make sure we remain open.
Yes. And in terms of recouping losses that have been not able, you know, you haven't been able to make any money for such a long period of time, how soon do you think you will be back in the black, as it were?
Well, there's estimation. I mean, I've spoke quite heavily with Sasha Lord and some of the other representatives up and down the country. We're estimating up to 5 years before some of these businesses retain some financial stability. Many of them have taken loans. Many of them are sort of borrowing money from families, taking, remortgaging their house to sustain their position. And, you know, it's a horrendous environment. I mean, even the furlough, the 10% commitment, if you think, if you're a nightclub operator, all of your staff have been furloughed. So you have a bigger proportion in terms of cash terms to pay out outside of other industries who potentially are part open and have a lesser amount of contribution to give in. So it's a very difficult situation where nightclubs have been really, really squeezed.
Yes, it has been really, really tough. And Michael, I can only say thank goodness finally you're able to open, and hopefully you'll be able to have a great summer, what's left of it, and into the autumn. We keep our fingers crossed, right?
Very much so. Well, I hope to see you out at some point.
Listen, I've been out all the time, and now that clubs are open, I may just have to pop into a club. Why not? You know, I don't have to go to bed till three anyway. We shall see. Well. Michael, thanks very much indeed. Michael Keel, Chief Executive of the Nighttime Industries Association. If you were out and about in a club last night, what was it like? Was it weird? Was it different? Were people behaving in a way that you didn't expect them to behave? I've got lots of you getting in touch about what's going on today. Freedom Day, supposedly. Doesn't look like much is changing the world of the GP surgery, because Tracy has sent me this that she's got from her local GP surgery. Dear patients, we're unable to provide any face-to-face appointments today due to shortage of staff requiring self-isolation. Please ring the surgery only if you need urgent medical help. Thank you. Should we give them a round of applause? Well done, guys. Very good. Let's clap for the NHS. Tremendous. What a collection of planks.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
And it's time to say a very good morning to Mr. Peter Hitchens. Peter, how are you?
Morning.
So, are you feeling free? Are you feeling as if the gloom has been lifted from your shoulders?
No.
I sort of expected that answer, to be honest. What's different?
A little bit is different. A few more people on the trains and railway stations this morning not wearing masks. Mm. But in, I haven't tested it out fully to see how it is. I haven't been to any shops lately, for instance. So I don't know. I think it'll probably be a larger number of people who will not do that. But it's still a very, 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 very large number who will continue to wear masks, it seems to me. And my view of them is that one has to be sympathetic to them, and they still believe that they're in danger. So we have to, as I've always said, it's like having members of a religion. I don't agree with them. I mean, I have to treat their beliefs with respect if they don't follow them myself. But I still think they have far too much power over the rest of us.
Well, that's the trouble, isn't it? My interest is in getting information today from people out and about as to what the kind of the shops are doing, what people are being told when they get onto public transport, because at the moment it
I
seems...
I can tell you that.
Go on.
I, instead of the usual lecture about how it's a legal obligation, there's now a long, an even longer lecture about how they would really like us to do it, please. A great deal of effort is being, you know, you cannot go on a train journey these days without being subjected to some constant hospital radio broadcast.
Yeah.
Sometimes lasting 4 or 5 minutes from start to finish. Mm. Well, along with the See It, Say It, Sorted stuff about the British Transport Police, is a long, long thing appealing to us all to carry on wearing masks.
Yeah.
Which has almost the same effect. I looking around, there were, I think, probably in the carriage that I was in, a couple more people not wearing masks who I think normally would have been. But in general, right, it's still, and of course, all the staff are doing so, and all the staff at the station were doing so. I would imagine they're under considerable pressure from their employers, yes, to do that too. You can't tell whether it's voluntary or not.
No, I mean, I've seen a couple of emails now, one from my son's bus company, Stagecoach, which he takes the bus to go to college, and saying, and this same phrase appears in both emails, the other one from Tesco's that we've just been talking to a caller about, please continue to wear a mask, and this is the key phrase, if you can. And that seems to be the new mantra. Now, I don't know what that means particularly. If you can, well, I could, or I can, but I may not.
There's been a very deep misunderstanding in lots of places about the nature of exemptions. And I think that continues to persist, but there's no point in trying to explain it to people. It is, I suppose, probably slightly easier now not to wear a mask than it was before. It probably still takes a bit of nerve for a lot of people. But there you are. I just wish more people would pay attention to the evidence. You may have noticed that last week I somehow got Nick Robinson of the BBC to reverse, yes, his position on masks. I mean, hectoring and saying they were assuming that they were effective, actually stating quite publicly in an interview that the loose cloth masks that everybody wears are no use, which I think is actually beyond dispute. I think any serious person, even on the mask side, imagines that those things can do any good. I mean, they're flapping holes on the side of them, even if people don't wear them around their chins. How this strange thing, I keep seeing young women, I think, how on earth is that woman, is she wearing a false beard? Because they've got them around their chins, in the way that people have those chin strap beards. And it's really, really peculiar. Of course she hasn't got a beard, but the way in which people wear them, half down or entirely down, is also fascinating. But and pull them out of their pockets and then put them back in their pockets.
Yes.
Anybody who knows anything about hospital mask wearing and the N95 mask knows you mustn't touch them.
Right.
As soon as you take them off, they have to be replaced by another one. They can't. They have to be tightly fitted to the face, quite uncomfortably. A totally different thing. So I don't want to encourage the authorities to demand that we all wear N95 masks. Apart from anything else, it would bankrupt the country because they cost about £5 a
game. Yeah. Right.
But it is a simple point which one can't help, but even people who understand this must know that these tokens which people are wearing can't really do much good, especially against aerosols.
No, and there really is very little in the way now of anyone who will say that they do. It's now, as we said last week, I think it's now become a different reason. It's now become, well, you've got to try and consider other people, and that's why you should wear it.
Well, sure, but there's this curious thing. I mean, can virus aerosols only travel one way through a piece of cloth? And we know that there's no proof that it protects us from infection. If they can't get in, if they can get in through the mask, then why shouldn't they be able to get out? Mm. But no, there are plenty of people, including, I think, there's a leading academic called Trish Greenhouse, who continues to believe very strongly in Master to put that position forward and get a lot of airtime for that position too. So it's not gone away. None of this has gone away. What worries me far more is how much of it's going to come back. I suspect that quite a lot of the zero COVID people and the rest of the militants who want to have us pretty much permanently under control for health reasons are waiting for their opportunity to say, oh, look, you relaxed on July the 19th. Mm. Look what happened. Look at these huge figures for so-called infections, which are, of course, obtained by having huge numbers of tests looking for them and don't indicate any actual illness among those. And then they point to hospital admissions. Well, hospital admissions, what do these figures mean? Mm. The last time I tried to look at hospital admissions connected with COVID, what I found was that the people were in hospital. They'd been tested positive for COVID, but you couldn't state simply that's why they were in hospital. They may have been in hospital with something completely different.
Yes.
As with deaths with COVID, are they deaths from COVID or are they people who died who got COVID? One thing we do know for sure, if you wanted to get COVID, the place to go would be a hospital where they...
Well, precisely.
It's astonishing. So it's not particularly surprising that people die in hospital with COVID, but have they died? But nobody examines these statistics in a particularly rational or forensic fashion, because there's this huge desire, both among the lobby, the zero COVID lobby, and the people who want us permanently under control, and among many frightened people, never ever to go back to the way we lived before. And we have to recognise this. This is not a liberty-loving country anymore.
No. And for some unfortunate people, and one of them, Ashton, has sent me a message today, a tweet, in which he says that his company have sent him an email suggesting that while it's great news that the lockdown has been lifted, they will be testing even more now that employees come into the office. They'll be testing them three times a week. Some people don't care about being tested. I refuse to be tested. I've never been tested. I won't take a test just because somebody wants me to. And I certainly won't take a test if there's nothing wrong with me.
No, I'd say there is the fear has gone in so deep, and fear is irrational. It's completely immune to reason.
Mm.
Has anyone ever tried to reason with a large group of people perhaps on a demonstration or something like that, and suggest that some of the things that they're saying won't actually withstand serious examination? Mm. Very rapidly the response turns to anger. People don't listen because they're safer in their certainty and fear than they would be in a reasoning world. And that's what we've come to. And the damage done to reason in politics and public life and broadcasting and universities and everywhere else by this is considered, they were really quite badly damaged. I think we've been turning away from reason and the proper scientific method in this country for a long while. But these past 18 months have been a major turn back towards what looks to me very like superstition.
Mm. Well, it's interesting. I used that very word this morning when I was talking to people, talking about the people, the numbers of people who are out there wearing masks. It is almost like a superstition that they're suffering from.
Well, is it? But before people knew things about diseases, they did have what were more or less superstitions, but were respected in a way as solutions. I mean, in my hometown of Oxford, there is a stream called the Trill Mill Stream. It was a filthy open sewer in the 19th century. And it was a great cholera outbreak in the before it was discovered for certain by John Snow that cholera was actually linked to dirty water.
Yeah.
The belief was that cholera was spread by what's called miasma, a sort of invisible cloud of infection, which came out of such places. So that the governing body of Christchurch, one of the great colleges of Oxford, and full of very, very highly qualified academic persons, voted to build quite high walls on either side of this stream, which are still there, to keep the cholera in. that was the level. And we seem to have reverted to this sort of view of disease as an impenetrable miasma, which can be kept out by physical objects, which I don't think in most cases is really true.
No, and it's certainly not provably true, and that's for sure. Even though people like Sadiq Khan continually say, "Well, of course there is great evidence to show that masks will stop the spread of the disease." Well, there isn't.
Well, he says it.
There isn't.
Well, he's never challenged to say what it is. I mean, look, of course there are. Hazmat suits and tight-fitting masks, particularly ones which cover the eyes, the sort of things which you would use in, an Ebola outbreak, which do indeed get in the way of infection. But I think it's impracticable to ask the mass of population to wear things of this kind. And that's the difference. Obviously, there are really, really strong precautions which can be taken, but these are so costly and difficult and very, very hard for most people to wear properly and to follow the instructions. That's not a practicality. But the whole mask thing, I think Graham Brady wrote an article in the Mail on Sunday yesterday saying it was much more of a political symbol than an actual protection. And I think that remains the case. People wear them as a sign of compliance with the new regime.
Yeah, which is rather sad. You also wrote in your column this week, Peter, about the police and Christa Dick in particular. She's obviously asking now for an extension to her what can only be described as troubled tenure, because I'm struggling to think of anything that she's actually got right while she's been in charge of the Metropolitan Police.
No, it's extraordinary, isn't it, the way she persists. But I remember reading an article about her, actually by an old friend of mine, David Rose, in the Observer newspaper many years ago, describing her.
When the Observer was still a good paper.
Well, yeah, and the thing, point was that what they were saying was this was a person who made bargains with demonstrators rather than and was in general the sort of police officer who liberals love. And she'd obviously, it seemed to me, been picked from a very early age that as someone who might well make the first female Metropolitan Commissioner. And I pretty much predicted it at the time. And I watched her rise and rise and rise. The fascinating thing people often don't realise is she'd actually left the Metropolitan Police and gone to work for the Foreign Office before she was picked for this job. She'd actually ceased to be a police officer and then came back to do it. It's a forgotten part. It's quite clear that what she symbolises. I mean, I have actually had some communication with her. She's a perfectly nice person. I didn't want to make it personal. What she symbolises is a new form of policing, the sort of policing that says that all crime and disorder is actually caused by social problems. That the job of the police is to be as paramilitary social workers. There is no more any right and wrong. The police aren't there to scare wrongdoers into behaving, which is actually the very simple description of what they used to be for. They're there for a completely different reason, and they're much, much more political. And their upper ranks, really since the 1980s, have been increasingly filled with people who can be described as strongly politically correct. And since the McPherson report, that accelerated. And then, of course, the recruitment of constables, the people who we actually encounter, has also changed. They're very different sorts of people from the sort that you and I will remember. Yeah. From the police. So it is a wholly different organisation with a wholly different purpose. And whatever it is any good for, I'll tell you what it isn't any good for. It's not any good for preventing or investigating actual crime. And it's not really very much good at policing against disorder at football matches. I've been saying this now. I remember when I first tentatively began to say it, getting into some trouble with my readers, more than 20 years ago. And I wrote a book about it in 2003, explaining how it had happened and where it had all gone wrong. I can't get any purchase on this. I say it over and over and over again, but whenever even apparently quite intelligent, literate politicians, but the moment they start talking about the police, they start saying, we need to have more bobbies on the beat. They always say it.
Right.
By saying those words, they reveal that they know nothing whatever about the police. There hasn't been any such thing as a bobby for something in the region of 30 years.
Right.
There hasn't been anything such as a beat for about the same length of time. So putting more bobbies on the beat is a bit like putting more aliens on Jupiter.
Yeah.
It just isn't simply something within their power. And yet they keep saying it because they don't understand what's happened.
Yes.
And they can't be bothered to find out. And that is just the nature of so much politics. I keep writing these books, because I think, I don't really know, I know vaguely what's happened, but I don't know in detail. Let's find out. And I go into the archives and I look it up. It's not all that hard to find. I suddenly find myself in possession of not very difficult to find, not very complicated knowledge. And I look at the speeches and remarks of politicians, I find they don't know any of this. And it's distressing.
Yes.
To me.
No, it's
and
very
distressing. I keep on saying it. It's not hard to find out what's happened.
No.
If you don't want this sort of police force, it would be very easy to put it right, but nobody does.
No, quite. Stay with us, Peter. We're going to stop for a moment. Peter Hitchens is here with us, Man on Sunday Columns. We've talked about the police. I've got some more things to say about Christa Dick and why the police force in London, certainly, and possibly in the rest of the country, is not fit for purpose, rather like so many of our actual public sector businesses. They're just not very good.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Talking to Peter Hitchens about a great many things, including, of course, the conduct of the police in this country at the moment, because one of the things that they were pretty much incapable of coping with, it would seem, Peter, was the Wembley farce at the final of the Euros. But not so, just the Wembley farce, the farce of what was going on in central London, which more or less got taken over by a sort of a rampaging mob of drunk people.
Well, yes, yeah, so they've showed this before. In the supposed riots some years ago in the capital, which were actually just an outbreak of disorder and looting, it took an amazing length of time to recognise what was going on and respond to it, and to pick up a few stragglers and bring them to court, rather than the people who were at the forefront of the looting and troublemaking, I think, got away almost entirely scot-free. It's because they don't actually have anymore the purpose which they were set up for. They have this social work purpose, which involves all kinds of decisions about who should or should not be deployed. Another thing which is going on, I think, in a lot of public services at the moment, which may have affected the response to the football match, is the huge numbers of people self-isolating, which is a major problem, I think, in all public services. I'm sure we're going to find shops closing and trains cancelled in increasing numbers because of this.
Yes.
And you say, well, given that the government could, by some small tweak, reduce the numbers of people being pinged, you have to ask, why don't they do that? And one has to suspect that the answer is that there are people within government who quite want to reintroduce a lockdown by the back door, which is effectively what this pingdemic is causing. So that may have something to do with it. It also causes problems for the National Health Service, which has very large numbers of staff isolating all the time, as well as the beds being much further distant from each other, which reduces its ability to respond to anything.
But this is the thing. I mean,
the whole thing is enormously complicated. As well as the police being just having the wrong idea of what it is they're for, they do also face this problem, and we have to be aware of it.
Yeah.
And the thing we discovered yesterday, which we didn't discover, we were re-informed of it, because we had already been told by Mike Hancock in detail, and by Dominic Cummings earlier, is that people who devise these policies don't believe their own propaganda.
No.
They don't, when it comes to it, behave the way they tell us to behave.
And all of the problems in the NHS, I was listening perhaps to the same interview you were listening to yesterday. There was a guy from something like NHS Support or something, one of those kind of ancillary NHS bodies, talking about how the reason why hospitals were having problems and struggling was, one, as you say, because they were spacing out the beds; two, lots of people were off because they were self-isolating; and three, they built up a huge backlog of cases which were not involving COVID because they hadn't treated anybody. And all of that is the fault of the NHS and the way the NHS is managed. None of that has got anything to do with the way COVID actually affected them.
Well, no, it has a lot to do with the way that the government reaction
to COVID. That's what I mean.
So the NHS, as we know, is full of good, competent, hardworking, courageous people. But it's not.
It's also full of completely useless managers.
Very poor organisation.
Yeah,
a different thing altogether. But under these pressures, any organisation would struggle. When you, at a moment of difficulty, huge numbers of your staff are unable to work because they've been sent home. And when your bed capacity, which has already been reduced by Labour and Conservative governments, I should say, far below where it used to be, is even more greatly reduced by this extra spacing, then you're going to struggle. And rather than banging pots and pans and saying how wonderful it is, it would be much, much more sensitive if people offered constructive criticism of how it was being run, and got politicians to pay some attention to it.
Right.
And the more you praise something, the less it's criticised and the less it will improve.
But the problem as well for me with the police and many of our public sector sort of leaders, if you like, is that they appear to have learned all of what they know about the business they're in, sort of in a lecture theatre rather than actually doing a job in the business, you know. And so with Cressida Dick, her sort of version of how to be a police officer is what she learned when she was in university rather than, you know, walking around.
Well, sure. I think she did a thesis on the miners' strike.
Great.
I think she can reply with, you know, though, that she did do the basic stuff at the beginning. She has been through the ranks. Again, it's not that the problem is not so much what she did as what she thinks. Mm. And what she thinks, so this has been the problem since Roy Jenkins revolutionized policing practically in the 1960s. What he did was he turned the police from a preventive force, which is what it had always been before. It was quite expensive, particularly in the new towns and the big new housing estates, to patrol. And they had, at that point, a recruitment crisis. So Jenkins responded to this by saying, well, actually, what we should do instead is react, put policemen in cars, let people bring them up when they needed them. But, of course, if you do that, if you wait for crime to happen, then you've completely abandoned your main purpose. Mm. Simple point. You cannot un-burgle someone who has been burgled. You cannot un-mug someone who has been mugged. You cannot un-attack someone who's been attacked. The whole point about the police was they had big visible stations in the middle of towns, which everybody could see, out of which came foot patrolling constables who were there on the streets and could appear at any moment and made people think, well, maybe if I do this, I'll get caught. Mm. And all that vanished. And then along came the political revolution in the police, in which they decided they were not really interested in prosecuting or pursuing crime. Mm. And they always say, we haven't got the numbers. I mean, I've been through this so many times. I went into the numbers, and they've actually got more numbers, both per head of population and absolutely, than they ever had in the days when they used to do the job properly. But it's what they always say. And when I began saying this, I have to say, I used to get a lot of stick from members of the public say, you can't attack the police, they're nice. And that's pretty much gone, because most people who encounter with the police is disappointing.
Yes, nice, not a word I'd be using.
Got the police coming out and saying, well, we haven't got the staff. And I went and said, no, that's a bit by bit by bit. After nearly 20 years of saying this, I now find, as with so many other things that I said 20 years ago, other people joining in. Well, look, learn from this, guys. I was right then. It was, you know, 20 years ago, I was right. If you listened to me then, we could have fixed it by now. And here are some other things I'm right about we could fix. Please pay attention a bit more.
Yes. I mean, it's not much to ask, Peter. For heaven's sake. Thank you very much indeed. Peter Hitchens, Mail on Sunday columnist, once again giving us the benefit of his wisdom. Just listen to him. You know, if only the government would listen to talk radio. They do sometimes. They do sometimes do what we want. But not enough, I think you'll find.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Many people saying that in some shops you've got about half and half. Some people wearing masks, some people not. The younger people tend to be not wearing them. The older people tend to be wearing them. I don't really have a problem at all with people wearing masks, if that's what you want to do. I just have a slight issue with how anything is policed at this moment in time. For example, there is an anti-lockdown protest going on in Parliament Square at the moment. People are saying, why? We've lifted all the restrictions. Well, not quite, because if you go on the tube right now and if you go on the tram in Manchester or in Birmingham, you are required, I believe, to wear a mask. But we've got to talk to Chris Philp, Home Office and Justice Minister, about a bunch of stuff, including a new bill in which refugees will be offered the chance to settle in this country. Chris, a very good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Mike.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. Can I ask you this question, just because I'm a bit unsure? What does it mean if you go on the tube and they say, would you mind wearing a mask? And you say, actually, no, it's a bit too hot today. I don't think I will, thanks. Have they got the right to stop you getting on, or have they got the right to make you wear one?
Well, I mean, that's obviously up to TfL, Transport for London, who run the underground system, and Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London.
Well, no, I want to know what the legal position is, Chris.
Well, I mean, when I was on the tube this morning on the way in, I mean, I chose to wear a mask. I think that's the right thing to do. I would have thought that Transport for London do have the right to...
Why is it the right thing to do, Chris?
Well, because personally, I think, I've got used to wearing it, personally. It doesn't really cause me any inconvenience. I don't really mind doing it.
But what if it causes other people inconvenience?
I'm talking about my personal choice, and if it protects other people a bit, then I.
But you've just said, Chris, it's the right thing to do, suggesting that it's the right thing for everybody to do.
Well, I think it's the right thing for me to do personally, but actually on this one, I don't normally support Sadiq Khan, but on this one, I don't think it's unreasonable to ask people to take this little precaution, which doesn't really cause anyone any inconvenience, and it might well help.
Well, why did the Prime Minister say that it was then down to individuals as to what they should do?
Well, in the case of Transport for London, they do have the right, obviously, to make the rules about what you do and don't do on the underground, and I think we have to respect that. And Transport for London has said they think we should wear masks on the tube. So, because I believe in the rule of law and all the rest of it.
But it's not a law. I'm asking you as the Justice Minister. It's not a law, is it?
Well, I think Transport for London are entitled to specify conditions about, if people using their trains should do this or do that. So I think they are entitled to make
that. Yeah, but what's the legal position? Because I'm interested in this purely and simply for myself and for other people who don't wish to any longer wear a mask, yeah, since it is no longer a legal requirement. Why would we be concerned about not being allowed to use the train?
Well, I would imagine that they don't have a power of arrest, obviously. Only the police have a power of arrest. But I would imagine that they do have the right to deny entry to the tube system if somebody doesn't comply with their various rules and regulations, like, for example, if somebody is drinking when they shouldn't be, that sort of thing,
right?
So
equally you can have an exemption because you feel anxious.
You can have an exemption if you have a particular reason not to wear it. But Mike, I've got to say, speaking personally as a Londoner who uses the train and the tube every day, I actually don't have a problem myself complying with it, because it's, for me, it's not an inconvenience. It might help other people. So why, unless you've got a particular medical reason, why wouldn't you want to do it?
Well, I find it very uncomfortable.
Yeah, well...
What should I do?
You should wear it, because that's what the... That's what
I should wear it, even though I find it uncomfortable and it's not a legal requirement.
Well, because Transport for London are entitled... I'm not used, by the way, to defending Transport for London, but they're entitled...
Well, I don't understand why you are.
Set the rule. Well, because I
believe...
They
went against government policy. Yeah.
And they're entitled to set rules, okay? And as a Londoner who uses the tube every day, I don't mind following that rule. And if it helps other people...
Yeah, but it doesn't help other people, does it?
Well, we've been wearing masks for a long time now.
I haven't.
Even if you haven't...
Okay, I don't wear a mask when I'm walking down the street, do you?
But if not in the street, no.
Because I don't wear a mask in the pub, do you?
But if it... Well, I do if I'm walking around, like, to the
bathroom. Well, you don't have to now. It's not... Chris, you don't have to. It's not a legal requirement.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things you don't have to do, but you might nonetheless choose
to
do.
Well, if you want people not to do something, why would you make it possible for them to do it? So, for example, if the Prime Minister thinks like you do, why did he make it possible for people not to wear a mask?
Well, look, you've got to take a proportionate approach. Right? We've had a bunch of legal restrictions that have been in place now for well over a year. And, those...
And they've all gone.
And they've all gone. But just because the restrictions have gone doesn't mean to say individuals or indeed other public bodies like TfL should stop exercising any caution and any judgment. Now, if you're walking down the street...
So are you saying then that if I go to a restaurant this afternoon and they have decided to do away with social distancing, as is their right under the new law, that they shouldn't have done that?
No, it's a choice they can exercise, okay, and the individuals can exercise. In the case of a public body like TfL, they are entitled to make their own rules about what you can and can't do on the tube. They've chosen to make a rule that you should wear a mask on the tube, and I'm going to respect that, and I think other people should respect
it as well. Why didn't the Prime Minister say the wearing of masks is no longer a legal requirement apart from on public transport then?
Well, because...
I don't understand the logic, Chris.
Well, it is logical, because it's completely logical to say that individual... Now we've restricted the national legal restrictions, it's completely logical to say that individual people that run restaurants or indeed TfL running the tube network can make their own judgment. And if they want to do something that's stricter than is legally required...
So you're quite comfortable as the Justice Minister with people being unable to access a service that they pay for by taxation simply because they're different from other people about wearing masks?
Well, look, I think... I'm comfortable with the fact that some public transport operators, like TfL, have decided to keep the requirement in place. They're entitled to do that.
Yes, but they're not entitled to stop people who pay taxes in London from using their service just because of a restriction which they've invented after the Prime Minister said it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, they're entitled to put those restrictions in place if they think...
I'm astonished that you would say that, Chris. So you're happy for there to be a two-tier society then?
I'm happy for, look, I'm happy for someone that runs their own restaurant or someone that runs their own pub or for, you know, I went to the theatre with my kids in central London on Sunday, the theatre had us all spaced out, or TfL running the tubes. If they think in their particular circumstances that it makes sense to require mask wearing or whatever it may be, I don't have a problem with that. And I will respect TfL's decision. Outside of that, walking down the street, I'll make my own choice. Personally, walking down the street, I wouldn't wear a mask because it's outside. And that's fine.
It's very bizarre, isn't it? It's mixed up. It's no wonder people say this messaging from this government is mixed up. I mean, it's quite ironic, isn't it, that the Chancellor and the Prime Minister on Freedom Day are having to sit in their rooms, not able to go out.
Well, I don't think it's mixed up because there's a very clear national position, okay, which is that the restrictions have all lifted. But individual organisations, if they want to go further, can do so. And TfL have chosen to do that. And as I say, as a Londoner, I respect that. And by the way, I'm not used to sitting here defending TfL, but on this.
Well, I'm sorry to have to have gone on about it for so long, but it's quite a big question, this, Chris, and I think it's going to be a problem for you guys. And I think that's why whenever you go back and talk to Cabinet, you should say that there's an issue here, because it's not going to go away. People are not going to be happy to be told that they can't use the service that they've paid for just because they won't wear a mask when the government have said they don't need to. You see what I mean?
Yeah, and we're obviously going around in circles a bit. I think an organisation like TfL running the tube, I think are entitled, if they think it's appropriate, to have restrictions that go beyond what is required by law. And you have that the whole time, right? You have people running restaurants may have conditions. But some restaurants or nightclubs have a dress code, right? And they won't let you in unless you're wearing certain clothes.
It's not the same thing.
People running an organisation are entitled to impose restrictions that go beyond what is legally required.
Are you legally required to wear a mask in Downing Street?
We're not legally required to wear a mask anywhere now.
Do you wear a mask in Downing Street?
If I was invited into Downing Street, would I wear? Well, I don't wear a mask in. In Parliament, I've been wearing a mask, and I've been sitting in Parliament. Unless I'm speaking, I've worn a mask in the Chamber of Parliament.
And is that going to continue? Sure. Is that going to continue?
I'm not sure if that's. Well, I haven't been into Parliament today, so I don't know.
Oh no, but you're in the government, Chris. I mean, are you saying in Parliament you don't need to wear a mask? What's the rule?
Well, it's up to exactly the same as TfL. Okay. There is no national legal requirement to wear a mask in Parliament.
All right. Well, let me ask you the question another way.
It's up to the organisation.
All right, let me ask you a simpler question. Has Parliament demanded that you wear a mask?
Well, I haven't been in yet, so I don't know.
What do you mean don't know? Come on, Chris. Have they demanded? It's quite a relevant question, given that you've said TfL have got the right to do it. Have Parliament done it?
Well, Parliament have got the right to do it.
Have they done it, though?
I don't know. I haven't been in yet today.
Right. Let's talk about this new plan for immigration, because we're just, as you say, going around in circles. I think you'll have a bigger problem if it turns out that you can go into Parliament without wearing a mask, but we can't go on the tube, but we have to wear one. But let's leave that there. Tell us about this new immigration plan.
Yeah, so we've introduced a new bill. It's got its second reading in Parliament today to be debated with or without masks. And it intends to do two things. It intends to be fair to those people who are in genuine need of protection. So genuine refugees who are in dangerous places, for example, somewhere around Syria, we're going to continue offering them a route to the UK via the resettlement programme, which has run for the last 6 years in particular. We've seen more people being resettled into the UK than any other European country. We stand by our commitment to the world's most vulnerable. But when people are trying to enter the country illegally and unnecessarily, for example, by small boat, we think that's completely wrong, and we stand against that. This bill provides additional measures to stop that happening, which I can go through in a moment if you want me to.
I'd like to know how you can stop them, because up until now, this year, I think, there's been several thousand people coming by that method, and none of them have been stopped.
Yeah, so the bill has a number of measures that will help. First of all, it closes some loopholes in the law to make sure that where people enter in that way, it is a criminal offence. And we're increasing the penalty for that from 6 months up to 4 years. We're also increasing the penalty for being a people smuggler, because most of these people are paying people smugglers. We're increasing the penalty for people smuggling up to life imprisonment. And we're also giving Border Force powers of intercept and turn around boats as well. So that's a whole range of measures there in this bill that will help address this problem, which is a very serious problem, as you say. The crossings on these boats are firstly dangerous, obviously. Secondly, they're unnecessary, because the people concerned are leaving France. And France is obviously a safe country. No one's fleeing war in France. There's no war going on in France. They typically pass through countries like Belgium and Germany beforehand. So where people can perfectly easily claim asylum if they need to, there is no need at all to make a crossing on a dinghy over to the UK. So we're determined to clamp down on that. Now, there's another set of plans.
But as I say, I mean, up until now, nothing has been able to stop them, though. What's going to be different?
Well, I just mentioned two things, the additional powers for Border Force and the much stronger criminal penalties, the 4 years imprisonment for coming in illegally.
But what are the additional powers? Are you going to arrest them?
Yeah, well, it means people who, and it closes a loophole that exists in the law at the moment. So yeah, absolutely, people who are piloting these boats, with the change in the law, we're arresting some already. I think we've had 65 prosecutions so far already, but we will be intending to arrest and prosecute every single person who is driving one of those small boats.
Right.
And that will happen.
And what's happened to the 65 who were prosecuted?
Well, I mean, quite a few of them have had prison sentences of 2, 3, 4 years, but we want to make those prison sentences longer to act as a deterrent.
Well, you want to kick them out, really, don't you? You don't really want to imprison them here at further cost to the taxpayer, surely.
Yeah. Well, the other part of the bill is designed to do exactly what you're describing and make sure that people with no right to be here, whether they've committed a criminal offence or they just have otherwise come to the country illegally, are quickly removed. And there are significant problems with the way the legal system is currently operating, because people are able to make repeated claims for maybe asylum or human rights claims or modern slavery claims over a period of time, even if those claims are repeated and they're found to have no merit. And that can delay the removal of people with no right to be here, in some cases, quite a long time. Mm. We think that's wrong.
Yeah.
And we need to have a legal system which operates quickly and efficiently, so people who have no right to be here do get removed quickly.
Yes. Well, I think if you can fix this particular problem, Chris, it will be a massive feather in the cap of the government, because this is something that a lot of my listeners talk about all the time, particularly now, for example, when you can't even go to France legally and come back without having to quarantine. People are arriving at Dover probably even as we speak who are not having to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's a huge problem. You know, our borders are being, violated. And as I said, there's no need to leave France. France is a safe country. It's not a war zone. So, and we're absolutely determined to crack down on this. And the bill gives us some additional tools to do that.
Okay, Chris, thank you very much indeed. Chris Philp there, MP, Home Office and Justice Minister as well, talking about a great many things, including masks, which I don't think he was expecting. Never mind. It's a big deal. It is a big deal. Because if it turns out, for example, in Parliament, you don't have to wear a mask, then I'm sorry, there's going to be trouble. As simple as that.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1 Monday to Friday on Talk Radio via DAB online or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.